Hi guys, thanks for tuning this episode of the Nick Egan Times. We have an awesome guest on this episode. We have Jeffrey Deskovich. Jeffrey, who has an amazing inspirational story. Jeffrey is from New York, who is known for being wrongly convicted in 1990 at the age of 17 of raping, beating, and strangling Angela Correa, a 15-year-old high school classmate at Peaks Hill High School. He made a false conviction, which he withdrew, and his DNA was excluded from that left at the scene. He was nonetheless convicted based on police testimony that he had confessed. He served 16 years, although he continued to maintain his innocence and appealed his conviction. He requested post-conviction DNA testing, but the DA's office, then heeded by Jeanine Pirro, refused to accept his lay request. After a new DA was elected, Deskovich gained support by the Innocence Project. In 2006, DNA testing was conducted for Deskovich. It excluded his DNA from the evidence at the crime scene. Significantly, the forensic DNA was found to match that of an inmate already serving time for murder. The latter man confessed to the attack of Correa and was convicted of her death. Deskovich was exonerated and released in 2006. He's become an advocate for criminal justice reform. In 2014, a jury found in favor of Deskovich and awarded him reportedly $41.6 million in federal civil suit against the county for wrongful imprisonment. Due to his pretrial settlement with the county, Deskovich was limited to receive $10 million. He has set up a foundation to work for reform, which has done amazing to this day. Welcome, Jeffrey, and thanks for coming on my podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. How's it all been going over there?
Very good. Very busy, but busy is good.
Cool. How has life been for you since the pandemic's hit, personally and professionally? How's life been for you?
Yeah, so it's been a mixed bag. So, I mean, personally, it's been very difficult in certain ways. The pandemic has kind of triggered me because there are certain aspects that are similar to incarceration. For example, you can't go, very limited, you can't go nowhere, you know, we're very limited on permission. It's hard to plan things, everything is kind of in your head, and you're going to carry it out at some unforeseen time in the future, the exact time of which you have no idea, and it's been somewhat isolating. On the other hand, I have been very productive, I've gotten a lot of work done, but in fact, I've done a lot of Zoom, so I've kind of learned a little bit of technology, Zoom, and other similar platforms such as Riverside FM and StreamYard and similar platforms. And you know, so it's been a mixed bag. I've been in demand. I've been making the rounds on a lot of podcasts, some internationally as well. So that part has been good. But overall, I'm just waiting for the world to get back to normal again.
Right, couldn't agree more with you. Yeah, the world really changed, and it's amazing too, I guess, the plus side of technology and being able to connect with people like yourself so easily on platforms like this. So that's, I guess, one positive of the pandemic so far. All right, let's just jump straight into it for the listeners. Take me back, for the listeners especially, what was it like growing up in New York? What was your family like? What was your life growing up initially?
So I grew up in Peekskill, New York, which is in Westchester County. So it was the suburbs. It was middle class, ethnically diverse. I lived with my mother and grandmother, my younger brother, who is 3.5 years younger than I am. And I was kind of like the life of the party in the apartment complex where I grew up at. So whatever I would suggest would pretty much be what we would do. If we're going to ride bikes, we're going to play Monopoly, we're going to play video games, we're going to play basketball or swim or any number of other games, one of which ironically was called Jailbreak, version of tag. So that was my life growing up. My father was never involved in my life in any aspect, so I grew up without a father, and you know, later on that would prove to you know, intersect with one of the police tactics.
Yeah, right. What did you like growing up in New York? Was it a great place to grow up?
I thought it was. I mean, it was, we lived smack dab in the middle of the city. You know, Peekskill's a city, but I mean, it's kind of deceptive to use the word city. It's called a city, but really, there's only like about 25,000 people that live there. But it was in the middle of the city. You could walk to everything. So I did have a sense of community, a sense of belonging. I like being in the middle of everything, centered.
Okay, amazing. All right, let's go to obviously what's transpired and what happened. Take us back and expand from the time, obviously, the specific incident happened and obviously how it all transpired and what happened with the police initially.
Yeah, so initially, so the victim, Angela Correa, was a classmate in two of my classes as a freshman, one as a sophomore. She knew her name. I mean, I knew her name. She knew mine. That was the extent of it. We were not even really on a high-bye basis. So one day she was missing. They made an announcement that she was missing over the school PA system. And I remember reading in the newspaper that she was missing. And then a couple of days later, you know, her body was found naked from the waist down. That was in the newspaper also. And there hadn't really been a murder there in maybe 20 years. I mean, it was very unusual. So it created an atmosphere of fear, rumor, paranoia. Parents were concerned with their own safety and also the safety of their children.
What happened after that? So what happened when the police got involved?
Yeah. So the police interviewed a lot of students in the high school, and some of them told the police that they might want to talk to me because I was quiet to myself. I didn't fit in. So earlier I described my life outside of school. But it was different in school. So I had skipped a grade when I was much younger. And so the kids in the high school were not the same kids that I was used to playing with. They were all a little bit older than me. They were into drinking beer and parties, chasing girls, and I was in playing organized sports, and I was not. So that made me seem strange to them, and that's why they suggested to the police they might want to look at me as a suspect. And then another thing is the police thought it was suspicious that I had an emotional reaction to the victim being killed. They thought, well, you know, you barely know her. But I was a sensitive teenager. This was really my first brush with death, and I had an emotional reaction. But on the other hand, it wasn't that different from everybody else because there were free mental health services offered to anyone who wanted it in Peekskill to help people process what had happened. So lastly, the police got a psychological profile from the NYPD, which purported to explain the psychological characteristics of the actual perpetrator, and I had the misfortune of matching that, so it's a type of reinforcing factor. So for about 6 weeks, the police played this cat and mouse game with me. Half the time they talked to me as a suspect, the other half the time they pretend like they need my help to solve the crime. They would say things like, the kids won't talk freely around us, but they will around you. Let us know if you hear anything. Stop in from time to time. They'd ask me opinion questions and congratulate me if my opinion was correct. So prior to being a teenager, I wanted to be a cop when I grew up. So that's what allowed them to pull the wool over my eyes. And then they did the good cop, bad cop technique, where one officer take a more aggressive role and the other one pretend to be opposed to what's going on. He pretend to like be my friend. And I began to look to the good cop as a father figure. So eventually, they got me to agree to take a lie detector test. They told me some new information had come into had come in from the FBI lab, and they wanted to. Some new information had come in to the police file, and they wanted to share that with me, and that would allow me to be more helpful to them. But I just had a first take and pass this polygraph. So the next day, rather than go to school, I went to the police station for the test. So they drove me across county from Peekskill, which is in Westchester County. They took me to town of Brewster, which is in Putnam County. So that meant I was not able to leave on my own. I was dependent upon the police. Three cops came with me from Peekskill. But the Putnam County, the polygraphist was a Putnam County Sheriff's investigator, and he was pretending not to be a cop. He never read me my rights. He gave me a brochure which explained how the polygraph worked, but it had a lot of big words in it that I didn't understand. But then I thought, well, I'm here to help the police, so what does it matter? Let's just get on with it. Then from there, he put me in a small room. I had no attorney present. They didn't give me anything to eat. And then he launched into his third-degree tactics. So he raised his voice at me. He invaded my personal space. He kept asking me the same questions. And he kept that up for 6.5 to 7 hours. He kept it up for 6.5 to 7 hours. So towards the end, he said, what do you mean you didn't do it? You just told me through the test result that you did. We just want you to verbally confirm it. And when he said that to me, that really shot my fear through the roof. And at that point, the officer who had been pretending to be my friend, he came in the room and told me that the other officers were going to harm me, but that he was holding them off, but couldn't do so any longer, that I had to help myself. Then he added, look, just tell them what they want to hear. You can stop what you're doing afterward. They'll stop what they're doing. You can go home. You're not going to be arrested. So being young, naive, frightened, 16 years old, I wasn't thinking about the long term. I was only concerned with my safety in the moment. I took the out what she offered, and I made up a story based on the information that they had given me in the course of the interrogation. By the time everything was said and done, I collapsed on the floor in a fetal position, crying uncontrollably. Obviously, I was arrested. I was charged with a murder and rape.
Wow, that's intense. And what happened concluding that? So, obviously, what was your reaction? What was your family or your mother and all those? Were you always after that, therefore, plead your innocence towards it? What's happened?
Yeah, well, my family believed in my innocence. But their belief didn't really translate into assisting too much on the morale level or certainly not after I was wrongfully convicted. Many of them didn't come to, but I'm jumping ahead. Just in terms of the trial of it, I mean, really, it was just me going to court, accompanied with my mother and my aunt.
And, being incarcerated at such a young age, what was the process like? Obviously, you were clearly innocent throughout the years. What was the process of consistently demanding your innocence?
Well, you're saying before I was convicted, up to the trial and during the trial, or are you speaking about afterwards?
Afterwards.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, I lost seven appeals. I mean, I lost seven appeals, and, you know, like I said, my mother was my only consistent visitor. The last 5-6 years, she would come to see me once every, 5-6 months. My grandmother used to come with her to see me, but then she passed away after 5 or 6 years. I had a couple sets of aunts and uncles. They would come to disappear, then come again. And, you know, then the rest of my family had not come to see me at all. So really, in a lot of ways, I essentially did the time by myself. I had to keep fighting off feelings of hopelessness, helplessness, thoughts of giving up, suicidal ideation. So it wasn't just, the loss of freedom. It was that aspect of it, too.
Wow. What was it like being there? I couldn't imagine, obviously, the grief and the hell you would have gone through, but in a generalized, way, what was it like? How did you survive? What was that like?
I learned different prison survival tactics. You know, you keep your back against the wall when something's happening. And then also, I developed like a little routine for myself. You know, so, I mean, I used to read books. I used to read three or four nonfiction books a week from 1998 to 2006. I used to go to the law library. I used to learn the law. That gave a sense of comfort. I used to read stories about other people being exonerated, and I used that for inspiration to keep going. I had a pen pal for the last year or two that I didn't know before that suddenly appeared out of nowhere almost, and right in the nick of time, I was kind of at the end of my rope. I would always openly ask them, should I just quit? Should I just, give up? Should I just commit suicide? I'm never going to get out of here. So all those things, role of sports was important too. I used to play chess and basketball and ping pong and sometimes I engage in this elaborate delusion, like if I was a professional player and so were the other ones, but it wasn't like kids, you know, having fun on the playground. I mean, I needed to get out of the prison for a couple hours. I used to listen to sports talk radio, but it wasn't really sports talk radio. It was more that, like, it was a lifeline to the outside.
Yeah, cool. I get that. And I guess getting out. So I couldn't imagine the joy, and obviously there were no words to describe, obviously, the feelings of emotions you would have had, obviously, being exonerated. But tell me about the process towards the end. So you're starting to get the momentum and traction, I guess, for the other inmate at the time, taking the blame and confessing for it. How did that all transpire?
So I wound up with the Innocence Project. I wrote a letter to a book author and care of the publishing company, but someone at the company sent the letter instead to an investigator, and she believed in my innocence because of the DNA explosion, and she suggested I write the Innocence Project again. Her name was Claudia Whitman. So I wrote them, and she lobbied them from outside the organization to take my case. She got other respected legal entities to do that too. Then I got lucky that one of the intake workers represented my case several times to the attorneys. So, because they initially said no twice, but then she got them to agree to take it the third time. So getting their legal representation was the best, was the first thing. Second thing was Janine Pirro left office, who had blocked me from getting DNA testing and fought all of my appeals. And the third thing is we got lucky that the actual perpetrator's DNA was in the data bank. So we took that DNA and put it in the data bank, and it matched the actual perpetrator, whose DNA was only in the data bank because left free while I was doing time for his crime. He killed a second victim, who was just 3.5 years later, a school teacher, and who had two children. So on September 22nd, 2006, the charges against a conviction was overturned. Went back to court November 2nd. All the charges were dismissed against me on actual innocence grounds.
Wow, that's amazing. And obviously you got compensated. How would you say that's helped in any way? Has that helped at all?
Oh, it's helped a lot. Sure, of course. I mean, you're released with nothing. You know, I mean, I was not able to obtain gainful employment. I lacked stability of housing. At one point, I was a couple of weeks away from a homeless shelter. I was always passed over for gainful employment. So the compensation, you know, I have things invested in a conservative thing. It pays a certain amount of money every month. And I know that I can pay my bills. I don't have that mental strain. I can feel confident. I can feel like a man, you know. It's enabled me to continue on education. I have a master's degree. I have a law degree. It allows me to spend my time doing this meaningful work rather than having to chase a paycheck. So it's helped in all of those ways.
That's amazing. Tell me about not doing the degree, and I believe you just becoming an attorney.
Yeah, I became an attorney not too long ago. Yeah, so I got a scholarship from Mercy College to finish the bachelor's degree, and then I got the master's from John Jay, and in pursuit of my dream of exonerating others as an attorney, you know, I went to law school and became a lawyer. So I got tired of sitting in the front row of the courtroom. I wanted to be able to sit at the defense table, represent some of the clients, make some of the arguments. And, you know, that entered some cases that are at the foundation. My organization, the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice, which I started using some of the compensation I got. And we have been able to free 11 wrongfully convicted people. We've helped pass 7 laws, and we have 10 cases that are active now. So I have entered some of those cases as co-counsel.
That's amazing. What those cases that you're saying, that obviously 11 people that you've helped as well, have they been similar to any position you've been in? Or like for example, you know, DNA going in the data bank, the blood bank that you said, you know, the DNA, was that similar? Or?
No, it was not. No, it was not. They're not DNA cases, no. No, those are non-DNA organizations, yeah. I mean, there's actually 4 times the number of exonerations nationally in non-DNA cases compared to DNA. So, I mean, they are harder to win, but it is possible to do it.
Well, and I guess you've got those emotional connections and relationships too, because obviously you can 100%. Relate on that level.
Absolutely, yes, definitely, sure. I mean, you know, I'm friends with the overwhelming majority of the people we've helped to get out. And, I don't look at them just as clients, but I can identify with them. I was one of them at one point, you know, metaphorically speaking. So yeah, when you are able to help get people home, it is an incredible feeling for sure. Just like, you know, you help pass a law that is aimed at criminal justice reform. And this is what you toil away for years and years and years at a time.
That's incredible. What inspires you daily now?
Just to continue to make a difference. I'm trying to get to the next level. And, you know, in the process, I mean, I am making a difference. I mean, I do speaking engagements and media interviews and work on wrongful conviction cases and, you know, chase donors, et cetera, et cetera. You know, other stuff related to the foundation, but I'm just trying to get to the next level. I mean, I'd like to increase my public profile even more. I mean, as goes the organization, and to some extent, as goes the issue. So that's the main thing that drives me. And I want to share that it's very healing. It's cathartic when I engage in the advocacy work, and that's how I'm able to not be angry. I take the energy that I feel and I channel it through the advocacy work that I do. And I have a mission in life, like I mentioned, you know, fight wrongful conviction and work towards, you know, broader justice reform. And I have a sense of inner peace through being okay with that mission in life.
That's incredible. Where do you want to take your organization, and where you're going with that? Where is that heading? Where do you want to take that?
Yeah, so, you know, I'd like to, so we have about 20 volunteers now, 2 part-time employees, and we have 5 or 6 lawyers that we work on cases with. But ultimately, I would like to be able to, again, have a full-time staff. I mean, to be able to do this the right way, it would cost maybe like $1.3 million per year to fully be equipped, to have everything that we fully need to really be a good force. And if we could get these type of results on a shoestring, imagine if we had a bigger budget. So that's the initial goal. And that would allow us to free more innocent people. And that would allow us to pursue policy changes more than just New York, Pennsylvania, and California. But beyond that, I would like to expand, have a chapter in each state and ultimately in each country, because I see wrongful conviction as a worldwide issue. Not simply, you know, an issue in New York, an American issue. And I think that countries where we don't hear about wrongful conviction, it's not that they're not happening. It's just that there's nobody working on them.
Right. That's probably not, depending on the country too, how much media or how much exposure or how much access they have to obviously getting them exposed too, right? So,
absolutely. Yeah.
Have you done any traveling since you've been out, like within America or internationally?
Yes. Yes, I have. Yeah, yeah. Yes. So I'll start out with the most fun, which is internationally. So I was in Argentina for a week. That was like a working vacation. I did a bunch of presentations and speaking engagements and media interviews and meet with governmental officials. But I also did some sightseeing and I did some fun things as well. I did something similar, country of Armenia, not Armenia, Colombia, but Armenia did a similar thing. But in terms of just enjoyment, I have been to the Bahamas. I've been to Dominican Republic. I've been to Colombia. In terms of domestically, I've been to Puerto Rico. I've been to Maine, Rhode Island, Texas, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, California, New Jersey. Illinois. So I've been to a lot of places. I've been to Florida multiple times, different parts of that. But I really do enjoy traveling. I like experiencing the world. So to me, new activities, new experiences, try new foods, go new places, travel. Those are all ways to experience the world. So I really do enjoy that.
You gotta come down to Australia.
I really would love to come to Australia. Yes, I would. That is one of the places that I would like to visit, hopefully within the upcoming year. In fact, I've been on a couple of Australian podcasts, and I have I have somebody that became aware of my mission through Facebook because I use it as an information sharing tool. And sometimes we send voice messages back and forth, just having some fun. And she calls me Yank. So I have, yeah, so I have some fun with that. So, yeah, I definitely would like to come to Australia, whether it was just recreation and pleasure or do some advocacy work or some hybrid, you know, have message, will travel, that type of thing.
For sure. We'll definitely have to link up, and yeah, you're always welcome, my friend.
Thank you.
Hobbies and passions do you have up?
Yes, I love to play chess. I built up like a chess library while I was incarcerated. I think that I'm pretty good at it. But I like it because you have to think ahead. I like going to sporting events. So, baseball, tennis, basketball, NFL. So I like going to games. And like I mentioned, I like throwing new things. I like the bumper cars. I really, I do. Yeah, I do enjoy that. I'm a people person, so I like meeting new people and having good conversation.
What do you see, speaking now, not getting too political, where do you see, you know, generally position going into the future, just generally?
The country, or you're asking me about me?
Country. Another country.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you know, I feel like the country is extremely polarized. You know, there's very little bipartisanship. I mean, I feel like it depends on, like, which party articulates an idea is going to be whether who supports it or not. It's no longer the merits of ideas. And so I don't think that that's healthy. I think that that's going in the wrong direction. And I feel like, as amongst the general people, that it used to be, on the marketplace of ideas, where ideas are bought and sold every day, you know, ideas rise or fall on their merits. And, you know, or in the world of philosophers, philosophers agree to disagree about a topic in order to increase their overall understanding of a topic. So the spirit of those sayings is the opposite of where things are now. It used to be, you know, ideas could be openly debated and discussed to increase understanding. And now people just avoid it. It all just becomes with strife and people hating each other over one political view or another. And yeah, it's kind of depressing, actually. I mean, at one time I had thought about a career in public service and at some point making the jump from the nonprofit sphere to running for office myself. But then I think, you know, like, I would be a servant of the people. So I would be going, you know, for the office I run in order to try to help everybody. And then what? Whatever party label I don't run on, the other half the country is going to hate me. It's not worth it. You know, so, but maybe things be clear up in the future, but that's my thinking now.
Yeah, cool. That's great insights. Thanks for sharing. Where do you see yourself in 10 years, generally speaking? What does the future look like for you?
Generally speaking, I think I could be like a household name potentially, like other noted civil rights heroes of the present and of the past. I see a movie, a book, a docuseries, maybe a musical. I see myself having helped to free a lot of people, having helped to pass a lot of laws. I mean, I am planning as an attorney, I am able to help people get compensated after they're exonerated. So like anybody, I mean, look, money's just a tool. It's not everything. I would like to make some, you know, some other money, do some other good. So I would like to, I see myself doing that and maybe there's some space to do commentary. I'd like to somehow break into the motivational speaking, world also. And I'd like to do more speaking engagements. And, you know, I do donate the honorariums from that I make when I do speak. So, and I would like to make more money doing that and donate that to the foundation. And I think that we could have a chapter in maybe three or four states if we can get in 10 years' time.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, your story is truly inspirational, and obviously what you've done now. Do you hold any resentment or are you bitter still at all? Back to you.
No, I did the first week, and it nearly destroyed me. And you know, I remember thinking to myself, "Look, I've got to let this go. I want to enjoy my life as much as I can. I can't do that if I'm angry or bitter. I've lost so much already. Why would I want to, in effect, lose the rest of my life? It's not like if I am angry or bitter, I'm not harming anybody other than myself." So the vehicle that allows me to actualize that is I take the energy that I feel and I channel it into the advocacy work that I do.
Yeah, okay. And how are your relationships now? Is your mother still alive? Have you still got a good relationship now with her?
My mother's still alive. We've improved our relationship, and same thing with my brother. And I've, reestablished familial ties with my extended family. So I wouldn't say I'm overly close with anybody, but I do make the rounds on holidays, and I do see them periodically, and I do enjoy it when I see them.
Cool. And I was also going to your high school reunion. Yeah. Obviously, you're obviously a bit worried about how they would take. What was that like? Yeah, tell me about the whole process of that.
I think it was a magical night, and I kind of found a part of myself and my community. And that night, I mean, remember that, you know, I was really a hated figure in Peekskill, and in Westchester, people thought that I was guilty of the crime. And of course, that narrative was assisted, you know, there was all the pretrial prejudice, the prejudicial pretrial guilt presumptive oriented coverage, you know, news reports of a confession, you know, facilitated that. So, while I did go, I mean, I had second thoughts. I was in the parking lot, and I had second thoughts. And I'm thinking to myself, what am I doing here? I don't belong here. I didn't graduate. This was a class I would have graduated with, but I didn't graduate with them. And who knows if they accept my innocence. And I was about to leave, and I heard this girl yell out, Jeff, over here. Come here, Jeff. And so I came inside, and, she greeted me, and she kind of babysat me for a little while, and then I made my rounds walking with other classmates. And every now and then, when the conversations would end, that was like my home base. I'd scamper back over there. But it was really amazing, though, just being able to see and talk with people and find out like where they were in life now. Like, you know, where were they living? What career did they have? What was their life like? You know, so it was very interesting doing that. It was very meaningful. I mean, most importantly, you know, they all embraced me. They all showed me some love, and, you know, they accepted the idea of my innocence, and they empathized with me. And, you know, it made a long way towards making me whole again.
Yeah, for sure. What's been the most humbling thing that's ever happened in your life to date?
Definitely the people that we've helped free. That's been the most humbling, just to think about the impact of that. Or, I mean, that would be it. Maybe a close second would be, I was in the legislature. I was in the New York Assembly, and Assemblyman Court was making a speech on the Assembly floor explaining why he is voting in support of independent oversight for prosecutors. And he referenced my case and wrongful convictions in general. And he pointed out that I was sitting up there in the gallery watching, you know, me and my colleagues. And, you know, that was very humbling. Also, it was kind of like an emotional moment for me.
Awesome.
But just knowing, but then also people have told me things like, well, when someone, like, for example, when I, following a presentation that I recently did, so a teacher let me know that a non-traditional student in the class said to her that following my presentation that she's sure now that she's going to go to law school, that she previously thought she was too old to do it, but she saw that I, you know, just from talking to me and learning that I went to law school at advanced age compared to the other students, that now she's going to go to law school. And so that's been humbling also. And there's been quite a few high schoolers around the country that have contacted me after the fact that they tell me, you know, well, that they had to do a paper in school about wrongful conviction, and so they did a paper about my case. So that's been, yeah, so that's really been That's really been amazing as well.
That's staggering, and yeah. That's true. If there was anybody listening, or there was anybody just generally that is doing it tough mentally, and obviously you've got to be mentally strong and extremely mentally tough. You know, I can even relate to obviously how strong mentally you would have had to be to go through what you've gone through. What advice would you give people? Anybody that's going through it right now?
Yes, I would say set goals. Have a realistic plan that you can look at 3 or 4 different ways and, you know, see, yeah, I could see, so we could say to yourself, yeah, I could see how that would work. Be flexible. Remember, the goal is the goal. The plan is not the goal. So if you have to vary or adjust your plan, or one door opens up unexpected, then you have to just adjust the plan but keep moving. There are no reasons why you can't accomplish something. There might be reasons why something is more difficult for you, but no reasons why you can't do it. Work really hard and never give up. And when you feel like you're about to give up, and I do this myself, I've done that while I was on the inside. I've done it out here, the difficult 5 years of freedom without compensation, and even struggling to get into law school or even to graduate, is when you feel like you can't go any further, then, you know, I tell myself, and listeners should tell themselves, you know, maybe this was the key moment. Maybe right now I'm on the verge of a breakthrough, but because I gave up, it's not going to happen. So even though I can't go forward anymore, I'm going to keep going anyway, and just to see what happens on the other side. And when you make it through, remember to do what I did. Reach back and help similarly situated people and do some work on the preventative side. So I think that commonality extends far beyond wrongful conviction. I know that it has application, whether we're talking about somebody recovering from a debilitating illness, or somebody who's homeless, or someone who's been a domestic abuse survivor, or someone who's been a sexual abuse victim. You know, you'll find it to be healing. You'll find it to be meaningful. You can make your suffering count for something, and you can make the world a little bit better. So I would advise that. And so I know that those lessons can translate out. And if you're fortunate enough to be amongst those of us in the human race that do not go through extreme adversity, I would still say enjoy small things. Things that, like, I used to take for granted. Things like fresh air and feeling the sun on my face and freedom of movement and trying new food. You know, I would suggest to try new things and appreciate the small things in life.
Jeffrey, that's purely inspirational. You're an amazing human being, and I truly couldn't even measure the words I respect to you and what you obviously have done today, even just being a great human being. You don't have to do it, but you're doing it, so you should be extremely proud, and I'm sincerely grateful for you sharing your story. I wish you all the best in the future, and just, yeah, keep going, man. Like, you're an amazing.
Thank you. Just want to mention something real quick in closing. If you enjoyed the interview and you would like to see more about my story, there is a documentary short on Amazon Prime called Conviction. You can check that out there. If you'd like to keep up with me, the advocacy work that I'm doing and my journeys in life, I do have a Facebook page. I have a public figure page there. I'm on LinkedIn and Instagram. Would like you to... We do have a couple of programs if you'd like to get involved in helping to free the innocent. So we do have a Patreon page, so you can help us to free innocent people. My dream, what if it was 25,000 people that were willing to sacrifice $3 to $5 a month on a recurring basis in order to free innocent people? There's the Amazon Smile program. You can register for your favorite charity, hint, Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation. And when you make a purchase, the Amazon will donate a small percentage to the foundation without it increasing your bill. And if you are someone who's formerly incarcerated, you have friends or family, please check out our a game I co-own called Recharge Beyond the Bars Reentry Game. It facilitates formerly incarcerated people with reconnecting with friends or family. I use the game myself. The game has icebreaker-type questions that removes the awkwardness from conversations. So thank you. Beyond that, thank you very much for listening to me do things that are meaningful. It's very important. Don't just do something for a paycheck. Do something that makes a difference at the same time.
Thank you for saying that. That's amazing. Yeah, Jeffrey, have a great day. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. All right, bye.